is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop. Yeah, stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and raw. Here is Steve Gruber.
All righty, it is Wednesday here, 6 minutes after the hour. Unchecked power. This is an interesting piece I found online. Unchecked power has allowed public unions, to establish member benefits that put a huge burden on you and I, the taxpayers. That, according to the Competitive Enterprise Institute in a report released yesterday. The report, How Government Unions Undermine Upward Mobility and What Can Be Done About It. It was written by CEI Journalism fellow Carrie Sheffield. She found public sector unions have been able to force policies through effectively crippling essential government programs. Through public sector collective bargaining, they then increase the cost of these programs, generally with little resistance from politicians, despite the burden on taxpayers. Ding, 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 ding. We have a winner, Johnny. That's why we have so many municipalities in this country that are broke. I didn't need CEI to tell me, but I'm glad they did. Public sector unions may claim they stand up for the little guy, but generally, they aren't representing blue-collar workers against a better-educated white-collar management, Sheffield said in a statement. Government unions represent skilled white-collar workers who enjoy big benefits and job security courtesy of the taxpayer. And the deals are made between the politicians and the union leaders to get their membership out to the polls, and we'll give you these big offerings of benefits and health benefits and retirement benefits and dental and optical and whatever it is. We'll give you all of these things, but you have to vote for me. Where I come from, that would be a felony. That is buying votes. Oh, wait, where I come from, they created a thing called Social Security in the 1930s, allegedly trying to help people. When really the whole goal and the thrust of Social Security is to buy votes, which they've continued to do for 85 years now. Buy votes. Don't you vote for those Republicans, you know, if you do. They're going to take these benefits away from you. Well, how is that not buying votes? And Social Security, I might add, was never intended to be a retirement plan. It was supposed to be supplemental income on top of whatever else you did. You did. Not what your neighbors did. Social Security is supposed to be here to be supplemental to what you did, what you earned, how much you worked. Not a retirement plan for you and your kids. That's not what it's supposed to be, and it shouldn't be today. And it is crippling financially. And I say that knowing full well I may never see any Social Security. In fact, it's likely I'll never see a nickel. Anyhow, often those skills go to waste as union tendency is to reward tenure and connections rather than merit. It's based on how much time you've been there, not how good you are at the job. Their procedures then stunt innovation and ambition, Sheffield concludes, often affecting people from the socioeconomic backgrounds most in need of the services the public sector actually does provide. Their monopoly on labor, the necessity of their services, and their propensity to strike make for a costly cocktail. Politicians rarely stand up to them either. Those few who do, like Republican Governors Chris Christie, Scott Walker, or Bruce Rauner, along with Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo, face long, intense legal and political battles, often at the behest of other policy goals. The public sector is where unions have been able to expand, while the private sector has seen a steady decrease in union membership since the 1970s. But the public sector unions have rapidly expanded. under the stewardship of feckless politicians. I think we got one on the line there. Steve, welcome to the program on the hotline.
Good morning. You know, this is not tremendously unlike the undue influence of, like an example would be the Michigan Road Builders Association, where they go up and peddle influence. And that is non-union. It's the Political Action Committee applications overall. It's not just the unions.
So what do you think it is? I mean, clearly you see a problem here. The relationship, and I've seen this for years. Obviously, there is a relationship between public sector unions and politicians that unfairly burdens the taxpayer.
It's not just public sector unions. It's any time you have a political action committee peddling influence. And until you do away with the total PAC network, you're not going anywhere. You're picking on a sector rather than to apply pressure on the bigger problem.
Unless we're willing to change everything,
political action committees in general.
So unless we're willing to change everything, we shouldn't change anything? That's your position?
Until you dissolve the political action committees, period, all of them, all you're doing is picking on a sector.
Well, no, you're correcting one problem at a time. I take issue with the way you're characterizing it. If you can fix one section at a time, then you're fixing one section at a time. You know, just because you can't fix everything doesn't mean you shouldn't fix anything. I don't buy that.
Why does one sector have to suffer when there's a far bigger problem? It's systemic. It's almost systemic.
I don't know if the PACs are a far bigger problem than public unions. I don't know if I agree with that either. I think public unions have been a detriment in many places, time and time again. It's not because of political action committees that Michigan's $150 billion in debt. It's not because of political action committees that Detroit went broke. Come on. That's not accurate.
Yes, it is. It is a piece of the bigger problem.
Yeah, but the bigger problem is
influence.
The bigger problem is politicians being in bed with unions oftentimes, offering great retirement packages, benefit packages, health, welfare, dental, optical, and every other damn thing you can think of. Anyhow, Steve, thanks for the call.
And political action committees. Look at the ineptness of this legislative body. They can't even get a bill through to fix our roads.
That may be true, but there are still public sector unions cleaning the halls of that fine institution. Steve, thank you for calling. It's 13 after the hour on a Wednesday. We'll take calls all day long on these topics, 888-900-9966. I appreciate where you're coming from, and welcome the conversation always. It's the Steve Gruber Show, 888-900-9966. By the way, brought to you by Mesa. Mm-hmm. Good business, good health, and great schools. Mesa bringing you this hour of the program, 888-900-9966. 888-900-9966. It's Wednesday on the Steve Gruber Show.
Keeping you in touch with Michigan and the world.
18 after the hour. Quickly back to the phone lines. Frank on the line in DeWitt today. Frank, welcome to it. Got to be quick, my friend. Frank, you ready? All right, Frank. How you doing?
Good. Good. Great show as always. I just wanted to say you were spot on about those public sector unions and the way you dealt with the Obama supporter that just came on. The only point I wanted to make, would you kindly tell the people out of the two political parties which one is overwhelmingly the one that is in bed with the public sector unions?
Well, overwhelmingly, I'm not sure, but certainly the Democratic Party has a much larger role. Well, because Democrats have been in charge of all the major cities in America for decades, so therefore they've been more closely aligned, deeper in bed, as you say, with the public sector unions. Frank, thanks for checking in. There you have it, 888-900-9966, the Obama supporter that called in earlier. See, now that's funny to me. All right, it's Wednesday on the Steve Gruber Show. And speaking of television, I've done television for years. For those of you that don't know, I have programs that run on the Outdoor Channel, have since, what, 1993 or 4, a long time. So if you want to see Ivy and I on TV, that's the place to go. Hunting and fishing programs. It's kind of voyeuristic when it comes to, you know, our adventures in hook and line adventures, like in Alaska and so forth. But there are so many shows out there. You ask yourself, can they really make a show about this or this or this? And you're going, really? Well, Julie Gunlock here, senior fellow at the Independent Women's Forum, bringing another one to our attention that makes me go, you know, it seems like it'll be almost painful to watch. But Julie, first of all, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on.
And voyeurism when it comes to children that are behaving to the point that I probably wouldn't be filming them. I'd probably be getting out a ruler. Of course, that's child abuse these days. But so it is. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so Discovery Family has launched a new show called Babies Behaving Badly. And indeed, they are behaving badly. I wrote a piece on Acculturated about this. And frankly, I think adults equally behave badly when they tune in and watch this stuff. And I think the parents of these children for submitting these videos are behaving badly. You know, I think it's sort of embarrassing.
Parenting gone wrong.
Children. These are really badly behaved kids. Sure, there's some cute clips, but these are badly. These are kids that are doing bad things, and,
yeah.
And it does, like just like you said, it makes you wonder why in the world are people filming this and not putting their phones down and actually acting like a parent.
Well, why would we want to do that? I mean, let's be honest, you know, most of those people were raised by, you know, the remnants of the hippie generation. So why would they want to be parents anyway? So it says here, if I'm reading this correctly, I just want to make sure I'm attributing this properly, Julie, that you filmed your own son having a complete meltdown because he wouldn't eat a meatball that, by the way, you said was pretty good. And then you had another one where he was freaking out, eardrum breaking freak out because he was strapped into his car seat and wanted to get out so he could kill you.
Yes.
And how old was he? Like 3, 4, what?
Oh, at the time. Yeah. At the time, he was probably 2. My youngest is 5 now. But at the time, yes, he was having a rather...
You see, and that brings me back to, shock collars like you use for the Labrador Retriever. I mean, if they work on the Labrador...
make a lot of money here, Steve. I'm telling you, that is a great business idea.
Why is your son wearing a turtleneck and it's July? Don't worry about that right now. It's not important. But he behaves nicely, doesn't he? I'm just telling you, Julie. Trust me, I'm going to get some hate mail for that one. Anyhow.
Well, I did film them indeed, but I kept it to myself. I said in the article, I showed it to exactly 2 people, my husband and my mother, as a way of explaining to them that I deal with these monsters much more than you do. You know, this was a private moment. I plan to trot out these videos later in life to embarrass them.
Of course.
Yes. So you know, but now it just seems so vulgar how people are submitting these for public display. Their children have no say in this. I'm sure I wouldn't be happy if my mom put some videos of me up where I was having a meltdown. So
but
I just find it all very disturbing.
I like your point of view, though. You watch your mouth, mister. On prom night? Right here, when your girlfriend shows up, that video is going to be on the flat screen. 65 inches of pure pleasure, pal.
I plan on torturing my children. I have no problem with that.
Exactly. Well, of course, you'd probably be guilty. The state will be there because that's probably emotional
right.
abuse of your children, you know.
Right.
And then she played the video and I looked like an idiot.
You know? I need a safe spot. I need a safe room.
I need a safe room. Hey, you know, you say that in passing, it won't be that much longer. Kids will be demanding safe rooms in their own houses because
truly.
Their parents are mean. Good God. You know, you have to have, you know, think-free zones is what I call safe zones on college campuses. You know, thought-free zones because we don't want to offend anybody's thinking.
That's right. That's right. Terrifying raising boys in this age. I worry about them going off to college with all these crazy feminists. So.
Oh, I feel the same way. My daughter will be fine. I'm scared to death of my son. I mean,
yeah.
he's got a short attention span like I do. He's athletic and aggressive and, you know, hard-headed.
Yeah.
And he runs through, like, fences and stuff and then, you know, cries for a second and gets up and moves on and breaks something else. And seriously, they'll try to medicate him in first grade.
Right.
Then they'll try to, you know, restrain him in second grade. And then, you know, he'll slap some girl, you know, inappropriate somehow on the playground in third grade.
Right.
And I am so scared to death of raising a son in this day and age.
Oh, I agree. I have 3 sons. I'm terrified. It's, you know, and you don't want to raise them to be afraid or nervous.
I didn't give him permission to look at me. I consider that to be sexual assault.
Right.
I mean, what? I mean, we laugh about it, but by God, we're not that far from being there.
We really aren't. It's so, so sad. And honestly, you know, you think about the the false accusations of rape on campus now. You know, people's lives have been destroyed, and there seems to be, you know, no recourse for many of these young men who are falsely accused. It's a really disturbing trend. I think, you know, when at IWF we write about that, we try to remind women, you may have sons. This is also, you know, a women's issue, because you should be concerned about the environment that the sons you are raising and the potential for false accusations, that you should be very, very nervous about. This
let me
is
just
also
tell
a
you.
Issue.
Let me just say, testicles are not a hate group. Yeah, I just put it right out there for you, Julie. Testicles are not a hate group. Now you go ahead and write about that.
That is a future blog post title, I got to tell you.
You can have it. It's true. I mean, testicles are not a hate group. Come on, folks. They're boys. This is what boys do. They run around. They break things. They scare girls. It's what they do. Anyhow, Julie, great conversation. As always, always a pleasure. You can find out more at the International Women's Forum. It's Julie Gunlock, one of my favorites. Julie, have a great day.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Getting your day started with news from around the state and around the world. Common Sense Radio. This is the Steve Gruber Show.
It's 33 after on this Wednesday. You know, make sure you have a way to record the program. If you don't, go to stevegruber.com. You can check out the podcast powered by Podbean. Easy thing to do. Go there and find the interview you want or the commentary, anything at all. In fact, we'll have complete hours of the program, or you can select individual interviews if that's what you'd like to find. And it's all there for you. It's all available. So just trying to make sure you have all the resources you need, and we'll go there. Let's see here. The RNC, the Republican National Committee, up in arms right now because there's a battle between New Hampshire and Reince Priebus, the chairman of the Republican National Committee. And the battle being the state's top Republican and key Democrats and its top election officials are promising to fight any attempt by the Republican Party to do away with the New Hampshire primary's first-in-the-nation status in the year 2020, 5 years hence. Secretary of State William Gardner told WMUR that regardless of what action a political party takes in using its power over delegate selection to dictate the timing of the primaries and caucuses, in New Hampshire, state law will always prevail and the primary will always be held a week ahead of any similar election. Now, the Republican National Committee will begin formulating rules for the next nominating cycle when it meets in January 2016. By next summer's National Convention in Cleveland, the rules will be adopted for the selection of the 2020 delegates and the nominating calendar. With the current campaign pushing into high gear and with no challenges to New Hampshire leadoff status apparent for the current cycle, RNC Chairman Reince Priebus threw a bombshell into the process yesterday by indicating the 2016 primary could be New Hampshire's last as first in the nation. Big deal to a small state, obviously. But let me think about something here. How cool would it be if it were passed around? What if Michigan were the first in the nation this time around? How much attention would we be getting? Michigan, who, you know, arguably we had the toughest economy for the longest period of time. Two other states trudged through it with us, Nevada and Florida, but arguably Michigan had 10 lost years of tough economic times long before the recession hit other parts of the country. Things were slow here. Our children are leaving to find better jobs elsewhere. And wouldn't it be something if the first in the nation primary were held right here in Michigan? Priebus told the National Journal that as the RNC evaluates the election process beginning in January, I don't think that there should ever be sacred cows as to the primary process or the order. Now, he said that during the process of coming up with delegate selection rules for 2020, no state will get special treatment, he said. It's a hot topic. These early states are very used to fighting this out every 4 years. It's just something I think we ought to look at as a party. If you look at my history, I've been very supportive of the early states as general counsel and as chairman, but I don't think anyone should get too comfortable. No, he sounded the bell. He sounded the alarm, no question. He certainly got their attention now, didn't he? He certainly got their attention, and you know, as well he should. And I happen to agree with him. Why is New Hampshire always the state that you know gets to decide, you know, who's the front runner and who's not the front runner? Because the national news media will fawn over or attack or do whatever they do to build up or tear down whoever comes out of New Hampshire on top. But why is it New Hampshire voters? Are they smarter than you and I? I don't think so. Are they more capable of deciding who should be the front runner? I don't think so. And it might be something to argue that a bigger state like Michigan, like our own state here, might serve the purpose is better by having a larger voter turnout, a bigger cross-section of the populace. Something to consider. While a state law ensures that the New Hampshire primary will be held at least 7 days ahead of any similar election, the political parties control the allocation of delegates. And the Republican Party in the current cycle has promised to punish any state that jumps ahead of the current calendar by withholding 90% of its national convention delegates. The Democratic Party in the current cycle would withhold 50% of the delegates for any rogue state. There has also been discussion on the Republican side of the possibility of instituting a so-called death penalty, which in future cycles would force candidates who campaigned or allowed their names on the ballot of a state that was not following the RNC's schedule to forfeit half of all delegates they earn nationally. I don't agree with that either. If a candidate earns the delegates, who the hell do you think you are to take them away? The party could also exert other pressure to keep candidates out of states that do not follow the RNC schedule, such as banning them from debates. Really? I bet that would go over big. You've got a candidate that's doing, you know, performing at the top or in the top tier. Oh, we're just not going to, you know, they went to a state they weren't supposed to. We'll show them. Talk about institutionalized garbage. And you wonder why people are ticked off at the Republicans and Democrats alike. It's garbage like that. It's our rules. We'll tell you how we decide who the president is. No? No, we're the voters. We'll decide who the president is. And that's the way it should be. Speaking of which, Republican presidential candidate Carly Fiorina has earned praise from conservatives for her stance on climate change. Unlike most Republicans, she has indicated that she accepts the science that says it is man-made, but she rejects the notion that the United States should be doing anything about it because it's too expensive and would take too much global coordination. But in a recent sit-down interview with conservative radio personality Glenn Beck, a snippet of which was published on Beck's website a couple of days ago, Fiorina indicated she may not actually personally believe what the majority of scientists say about the reality of climate change. Go.
You believe in global warming, that it's man-made?
No, I didn't say that. What I said was,
you are good.
Scientists tell us that global warming is real and man-made. Scientists also tell us this. The only way with current technology to solve the problem of global warming is a global coordinated effort over 30 years costing trillions of dollars. Now, what do we suppose the chances of that are? Zero.
Yeah, you have said, so this is one of the good things.
So
the government has limited ability to address it.
Exactly. So what are we doing? So here all these progressives say, oh, well, it's science. This is why we're rolling out all these rules. By the way, we're not a nation of laws anymore. We're a nation of rules that are promulgated by a bunch of unaccountable, unelected bureaucrats who answer to no one. So when the EPA rolls out all these rules that destroy the coal industry, I've been in those towns.
And she's right. We had that conversation here on the program with her just here recently when she's most recently on this program. About time to have her back again, wouldn't you say? It's a good conversation to have with Carly Fiorina right here on the program. It's 41 after the hour. I appreciate your support here today. It's the Steve Gruber Show. The phone number to call in is 888-900-9966, 888-900-9966. You can also check us out online, stevegruber.com. Like I said, it's a place to Hit the listen live button, take us to work, or check out the podcast, or post your comments and thoughts. If you have a question for the program, you know, drop in, drop us a line. I'll read it right here on the air. 41 after on the Steve Gruber Show.
Michigan, born and raised with Midwestern values and Michigan common sense.
Sheepdog, standing in the rain. Bullfrog, doing it again. Some kind of happiness is measured out in
all
miles.
All right.
What makes you think you're something special?
It's Wednesday, it's 45 after.
Childlike, no one understands.
All right, then. A story out of Flint here that I found interesting with the ongoing problem with the water in that city affecting so many people in WFNT listening area and around that entire region of the state concerned about water quality, especially when it comes to children and well, frankly, anybody else who uses the water, right? But Governor Rick Snyder quietly helped deliver 1,500 water filters to Flint last month, even as state officials gave assurances that the city's tap water was safe and meeting all regulatory standards. Well, apparently there was bigger problems. And so the governor was as part of that deal. Dave Murray, a spokesman for Rick Snyder, confirmed that the filters distributed by the concerned pastors for social action came from a corporate donor that does not wish to be recognized, but cares deeply about the community of Flint. The state's involvement in the filter distribution was never publicized, and pastors told the Flint Journal yesterday that they were asked by staffers in the governor's office to keep it to themselves. Now, why is that? In this report from MLive, Flint City Councilwoman Jackie Poplar raised the subject during a council meeting Monday of this week. As officials discussed the potential for Flint to reconnect to the Detroit Water and Sewage Department, recent testing and studies show lead levels have been rising both in water and in children's blood. Those filters came from the governor, Poplar said. The governor seems to be the one with the golden key to make something happen. Pastors involved with the giveaway of the filters, which were designed to remove total chemicals. Trihalomethanes, TTHMs, as well as lead from the water, said they accepted the condition that they'd not discuss the state's role in securing the equipment. That came from Reverend Alan Overton. So, I mean, this is the governor obviously knew there was problems with the Flint water system for a period of time now, and we're going to reach out to the governor and see, why they were told, the folks in Flint, to keep that to themselves. We keep an eye on that for you. 47 after the hour. Our next guest, Ken Braun, who follows politics closely in the state, and it's an important year, works at the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, and says that John Kasich needs to become the guy that needs no introduction. The Ohio governor has been a guy that I've told you for a very long time I think has the right credentials, potentially. He's one of the people I believe that could rise at the end of this contest, become the GOP nominee. And if you didn't notice in the last NBC Wall Street Journal poll, Kasich has now moved into either fifth or sixth spot. He's moved up at 6 percentage points, which you say, well, 6 points doesn't mean much. Well, he started at 1 or 2. He's tripled his numbers. He's on a steady climb. Ken Braun, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
We don't have a lot of time here, but tell me what you think of Kasich and his chances at this point in the race.
Well, I think the race is boiled down to kind of a top tier of 3 or 4 candidates and a middle tier, and then, some people that I think you'd put Santorum and Huckabee and the like down in a lower tier that just doesn't have a prayer at all.
Agreed.
And that top tier is very fluid, and at this point, when you've got George Bush pulling whatever it is, 7 points or something, anybody's got a chance at that point in those middle tiers, just because it's so crazy. So I think he's got as good a chance as anybody that doesn't have the big bucks that a Bush or a Rubio has. So we'll see.
But Kasich has quite a bit of money, and he also has the backing of John Sununu, arguably the most important man in New Hampshire politics. He's sitting very good in the polls there. He's dominating Ohio. He's now back in Iowa. Mm-hmm. You know, the knock on John Kasich is the fact that he, you know, endorsed and put forth the Obamacare expansion in Ohio without fighting it like some Republican governors did. That's one of the knocks on him. People say he's too moderate and won't work. And I say he's, more middle of the road, and therefore he's electable. That's my position.
And certainly his record in Ohio and the, you know, the big 30-point win he had in re-election last year and the 60% approval rating he has now argues pretty strongly that he's very popular in the kind of states that you got to win to become president.
That's right.
And also regarding the liability you just mentioned about the health care issue, that's a liability in the primary, of course, not in a general election. And it just cries out for the one, you know, the types of things he's going to need to do to actually get to break through in this race. He needs to put together a health care plan of his own that is going to resonate with those primary voters in Republican primaries, kind of in the sense that, you know, a lot of candidates that catch fire in the past have had a single idea that just resonates very quickly that shoots them to the top of the pack. You know, Herman Cain had a 999 plan the last cycle that just people understood it. It was easy to know, and it put him in the front of the race as a signature.
But briefly, I would argue that a slow, steady, the tortoise approach might be the best approach when you start with a field of, you know, 17, 18 candidates. The Kasich slow tortoise approach, last guy to get in, started with 1%, then 2, then 3, now 6, number 2 in New Hampshire, number 1 in Ohio by a mile. That maybe his slow and steady approach with just, you know, talking about his ideas and shaking hands might be the way to get there. I'll give you 20 seconds for the last word, Ken.
Yeah, I think that that's kind of something to argue for it. I would say, though, that for the things that he has a... He needs to inoculate himself against those criticisms about on the health care issue. And if he creates something that's just so exciting to those primary voters, they're going to say, oh, wow, yeah, this is really what we want instead of Obamacare. That'll pretty much put to rest any concern about his liabilities on that issue. And like you say, allow him to just keep jumping up there.
Well, it's a fair point you're making. Ken, I appreciate your time here. Ken Braun, everybody, from the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. Thank you, Ken.
Glad to be on.
52 after on a Wednesday here on the Steve Gruber Show. The best guest for you every day. We'll be right back.